From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Journalist Slavinka Drakulic lives about 40 miles from the fighting in Bosnia, but her life and her city have been dramatically changed by the war. On today's Fresh Air, we call her at her home in Zagreb, the capital of Croatia. Also, what's the physiological difference between singing jazz and singing opera? We'll get a demonstration from Judy Niemack. She gave up opera for jazz, studied with saxophonist Warren Marsh, and as you'll hear, she does wonderful things with jazz and pop standards. And book critic John Leonard has a review of Chinese Roundabout, a collection of essays by Jonathan Spence. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Russian leader Boris Yeltsin expressed satisfaction following his meeting today with G7 leaders, NPR's John Idstey reports.
Yeltsin and German Chancellor Helmut Kohl held a joint news conference after the talks. Kohl said it had been a meeting of partners, all of whom would benefit from democratic and economic reforms in Russia. Yeltsin added that if the current reforms collapsed, the cost would be higher for everyone. However, Yeltsin repeatedly expressed confidence that Russia had left communism behind and was returning to its historic place among European nations. Yeltsin said the recent agreement on Russia's economic reforms, signed by Russia and the International Monetary Fund, would bear fruit in freeing up Western aid. But the Russian leader said that the $24 billion promised by Western governments would need to be supplemented by hundreds of billions in private investments to ensure the transformation of the Russian economy. I'm John Idstey in Munich.
The president of Bosnia said today that he'll ask President Bush for U.S. military intervention, weapons, and money to help break the Serbian siege of Sarajevo. President Alija Izetbegović will meet with President Bush tomorrow during the European Security Conference in Helsinki, Finland. Bosnian officials said that more than one Western government has offered to sell them weapons if the United Nations and the European Community don't intervene militarily. The Bosnians refused to say what countries had offered the weapons. The United States has said it could provide warplanes to guard relief convoys on their way to Sarajevo, but does not foresee deeper military involvement. Canadian politicians have struck a deal to dramatically alter their constitution. The deal would see substantial power shifted from Canada's federal government to the provinces and give Canada an American-style Senate. Richard Reynolds reports.
This is the third time in the past 5 years a deal has been reached to amend Canada's constitution. The first two efforts failed. In each case, the changes were instigated by the need to placate the separatist-minded province of Quebec. Many French-speaking Quebecers say they would choose independence unless the rest of Canada agrees to change the Constitution in order to give Quebec more power. It remains to be seen if the package of amendments will satisfy Quebec. As well, the federal government may veto the deal as it gives Canada's Senate new powers to block legislation. Right now, the Senate is a powerless body, but under the agreement, it will be closer to the U.S. Senate, with 8 senators representing each province. For National Public Radio, I'm Richard Reynolds in Toronto.
Stock prices were down slightly today at the close of a session of seesaw trading. Corporations will be issuing their second quarter earnings reports over the next few weeks, and traders are reportedly worried that the results will be disappointing. The Dow Jones Industrials lost about 2 points to close at 3,793. This is NPR News. A federal judge in New York has frozen the American assets of a Saudi Arabian sheikh who's been indicted in the BCCI scandal. The order prevents Sheikh Khalid bin Mahfouz from removing any property or assets from the United States. The order came as the Federal Reserve Board disclosed that it's seeking a $170 million fine from the Saudi banker. Khalid bin Mahfouz was indicted last week by a Manhattan grand jury on charges that he and an associate tried to defraud BCCI depositors of more than $300 million. Yesterday, Khalid resigned as chief operating officer of the National Bank of Saudi Arabia. The roadblocks that have paralyzed traffic in France for 10 days are finally being lifted throughout the country. The end of the strike came after one of the truckers' unions called on its members to take down the barricades and return to work. From Paris, Lynn Terry reports.
A major truck drivers union told its rank and file today to stop protesting, and that's what most drivers are doing, even though very few are unionized. Drivers who persist in manning roadblocks have had their windows smashed by police, and a few have been arrested. Officials are hopeful traffic will be back to normal soon, but the effects of the strike could last some time. Several car factories have been forced to shut down because of the lack of parts. Other businesses have laid off thousands of workers for the same reason. The head of a local council in southern France has asked the government to declare his area a disaster zone. The 9-day strike has also hurt the image of the government, which is worried about the legislative elections next year. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Amoco Corporation said today that it'll cut its workforce by more than 15% over the next 18 months. The oil company said it will eliminate 8,500 jobs by the end of 1993. More than 1,000 of the job cuts will take place in the Chicago area where Amoco is based. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. War reaches you psychologically, even if the fighting is several miles away. My guest, Slavinka Drakulic, is a journalist who lives in Zagreb, the capital of Croatia. This is about 40 miles from the fighting in Bosnia. We called her at her home in Zagreb to find out how her life and her city are being changed by the war. Drakulic is currently completing a book of essays about the war between the countries that were once held together as Yugoslavia. She's also the author of a recent collection of essays called How We Survived Communism and Even Laughed. And she has a new novel called Holograms of Fear. Last fall, a couple of sites were bombed in Zagreb, and there were up to 18 air raids a day. Now she says things may look comparatively normal, but they're not.
If you would come to Zagreb, what you would see is a kind of totally schizophrenic life. You would go to the bookstore, you would buy books, you go to the store, you would buy food, there is everything to buy. You would go to the coffee and you would just sit there and have your coffee and you would sip your coffee in peace. But at the same time, you would know that the front line is very nearby, you wouldn't hear anything. What you would see is the refugees. There is a lot of refugees in the city. And you would see the poverty of the city. You would see that this city is different than a year ago or 2 years ago. So it is happening in a different way. The war to Zagreb is happening in a different way, I would say, as much as to me, because I personally haven't been touched by destruction or by death. But I think it changed me entirely from within.
There are thousands of refugees now in Zagreb. One of them is a close friend of yours who is a journalist from Sarajevo who fled Sarajevo in late April. What has it been like for you to see her as a refugee?
First of all, it has been painful because it's a friend and it's a colleague, and she is a single mother, and she escaped on the last day when it was possible to escape from Sarajevo by normal means of transportation. And it was just the day before her daughter's sixth birthday. So it was really painful to see that, but we took good care of her. We put her in an apartment. She stayed first with a friend, and then we found an apartment for her. She now has even a job here as a journalist. She's a correspondent to the Bosnian newspaper, and there are difficulties, of course, to send the reports there. And so, I mean, you know, in terms of practical, everyday things, I think things are okay. There are about 200,000 of refugees, I think, in the city of Zagreb, so you can see them everywhere, and you can feel them, you know, being in the city. You can feel them, you can see in the streets who is a refugee or not.
I mean, how can you tell?
Well, because the way they are dressed, and also by the accent, by the way they speak, and also there are some gathering points where you can meet them, like Moscow, for example. And also by the way they wander the streets, because these people don't have anything to do. They are frightened. They are lost. You know, this is the big city, and you know, people are not always very friendly to them. This is one of the phenomenon of this war of schizophrenia, because people living in Zagreb, they want to pretend that there is a normal life, they're trying to go on with their normal life. But there is also some psychological thing that happened, you know, with my friend Dražena, and I think it's even more indicative. It's more important for me because it indicates the change that happened to me during the 1 year of war, you know.
What happened?
What happened to me is that she came to my house, and my daughter, my grown-up daughter, she's 23, she gave her a pair of shoes, a pair of high-heeled patent shoes, you know, the shoes that you kind of wear it to the party. It's not the normal shoes. It's a nice shoes, a nice pair of shoes. And then when she left the house, Dražena, my friend, I asked my daughter, "But why did you give her that pair of shoes? She doesn't need such as shoes." And my daughter burst out, you know, she was very angry with me. She said, "But how could you say such a thing? Do you think that because she's a refugee, she's not a normal woman?" No, it's on the contrary that she needs to feel normal. She needs to have these kind of things, you know. And why, after all, do you expect all refugees why not to walk not only in sneakers but barefooted? And then you start to think about the perception. How come that I put my friend into category of the refugees, which is a broad category, which is a common denominator, you know? As soon as we accept this division, you know, between us and them, us non-refugees and them refugees, we are also ready to accept any other kind of division. And this is how once we start to divide, you know, there could be any kind of divisions, and it could be division on Germans and Jews, on enemies and friends, on inside enemies, outside enemies, you know. And all kind of divisions are possible, and then this, you have this concept of otherness arising, and you can feel it in you. And this is the point when I realized that, you know, the war came to me. It is inside me. It's not only a mythical animal coming, approaching me slowly, but it is in me, in my way of being a conformist, in my way of collaborating with the war, of saying, well, just if I'm safe, if I'm okay, if my friends are okay, then everything is okay, you know. But I just can't take it all. I cannot take the sins of whole the world, you know. And this is this feeling, you know, that somehow I failed with Dražena, that somehow, you know, I didn't do everything because I was so ready to deny her personality, you know. She became a refugee, you know. I reduced her to the common denominator, and I think this is when I realized that I have changed too.
What kind of assistance would you like to see the United States and European countries giving? What do you think those countries' responsibilities are?
Are you speaking now on a strictly political level?
Well, I'm speaking actually more probably on a military level.
Well, it's political level. I don't like United States coming in as a big policeman of the world, you know. But the thing is that at this point, I don't think anyone could stop these people destroying Sarajevo, destroying Bosnia and Herzegovina. There is no one. Europe is too weak. Europe is not united. Europe cannot act as if Europe, you know, EC hands are tied up. And they are not really acting. Even, you know, Mitterrand went there, you know, and it was very demonstrative. It was a very brave act. But what happened after there is that, you know, the airport opened, but the war didn't stop. Now, Dražena is right now sitting in my garden again. And what she told me, she came in tears. And she told me that via Paris, via one fax from Paris, she heard that five people from her paper have been killed last night, five journalists from her paper. Their chief editor is now without one leg, you know, and five other people have been killed. It means that the war, it happened last night. The Sarajevo was burning last night. The war goes on. Humanitarian aid is okay, it's good, it's wonderful, but it's not the end of the war, you know.
What makes us different from a civil war that another country would not want to intercede in?
Because I don't think it is a civil war. It is a war between two states. It's not a civil war. It's not just keep happening. We cannot see it any longer in terms of happening within one country, which is Yugoslavia. There is no Yugoslavia. There are separate countries. And I think that the most dangerous thing is that it's very hard to realize are two things. One is that this war could spill over the borders of ex-Yugoslavia into Greece, into Macedonian question is a very burning question. And then there is Greece, there is Albania there, you know, there is Bulgaria and so on and so on. The other thing is, I think, and it is absolutely on the more psychological and subconscious level, is that Europe doesn't want to name it, doesn't want to say there is a war going on in Europe, because there is this idea that it couldn't happen again in Europe, that we have learned everything from during the Second World War, And now what is happening is only a civil war, not a major war in Europe, you know?
Yeah.
No one wants to see that. No one wants to name it. Because if you once again say this is a war in Europe, then it puts in danger every single country and its borders.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Croatian journalist Slavinka Draculic, and she's now a contributor to The Nation, and she's the author of the collection of essays How We Survived Communism and Even Laughed, and of the new novel Holograms of Fear. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Slavinka Draculic, who's talking to us from her home in Zagreb. Are you thinking of leaving Zagreb and going, for instance, to the United States, where I know you have a lot of friends and colleagues?
Well, you know, every time when I come to the United States, they always tell me, please stay, don't go there, it's too dangerous. But, you know, it's very difficult to leave the country. It's, I think, one of the most difficult decisions one can bring into life. You really have to feel threatened, you know. What I feel is that, you know, Zagreb is functioning pretty normally. And I'm a journalist and I'm a writer. And this is my language and this is where I belong. And it's very hard for me to leave. And I have seen so many of my colleagues, you know, who left. And they were suffering, really, you know. And I thought, well, you know, this is, how can I go away? I mean, it's very difficult to leave. I'm living here. I'm traveling a lot. This is the truth. But I'm living here and I'm writing about it. I just wrote a book about the war. And this is the best way for me to somehow fight back, you know, the whole situation. This is what, this is how I fight the war. And this is my kind of, you know, fighting the war, you know, by writing. And I don't think that you can sit anywhere else and write about it, but you have to sit here. You can't write a book about the war by sitting somewhere else, right?
I've always thought that there was a certain magic in being able to understand when that moment is right before it's too late to get out, you know, right before you're going to be physically threatened.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. And I think this was the big question for me was how the Jews during the Second World War, didn't they see it coming? Why didn't they go away? Why didn't they, I mean, it was very clear what was happening. Now, when you look back at it, of course, it was really clear what was happening, you know. But I think it is very difficult to judge when is the right moment. And I think, of course, your life might depend on that, but it is very personal decision. It is very personal. No one can help you in that. You are entirely on your own, and it is so frightening to be entirely on your own. What I find for me is the most difficult thing in this war is the loneliness, you know. I have never been so much alone in my life. I've been utterly, totally, devastatingly alone in this war because I don't think that this kind of fear, this kind of suffering, this kind of a change that the person is going through, there is no one else can understand you, only the people who are going through that too, you know. So I think, I don't know, about the moment to go, yes, it is very difficult to decide, and we have to decide, I mean, every single person for herself, you know. But
well, you're a mother, too. How old is your daughter now?
My daughter is not living here.
Oh, she's not?
No, she's not. She lives for a year now. She lives in Austria. I couldn't bear the idea that she would live here under the circumstances we are living, I told her to go. I told her to go, and I'm very often thinking, did I make a mistake? Maybe I should, you know. Of course, she's grown up enough to decide on her own, you know. But I was the one who was so much frightened for her, even if she's a woman, not a man. She didn't have to carry a gun. But I was really devastated by mere thought that she would stay here. And then when I saw that she's cracking, that she's just, you know, she couldn't stand this situation psychologically, I advise her to go away, so she's not living here.
You must miss her a lot.
Well, this is one of the reasons that, you know, that I am relieved by this fact, but also this is one more thing that makes me, you know, even more lonely.
Yeah.
Also, there is now a gap between me and her because she doesn't understand what I'm going through.
Right. Are most of the men you know in the military now?
Yes, they are. Just today, a friend of mine told me that her boyfriend is going to Dubrovnik, and she was crying on the phone. So there are daily these kind of scenes, you know, somebody is going or somebody got hurt or wounded or something like that. Most of the men are in the military, yes.
How is it changing the community that you live in to have a lot of the men gone? Are women doing different things than they've usually done?
No, not really, you know, not in Zagreb. Not in Zagreb. Women are doing what they have been doing, you know, they're keeping their jobs and their... But their personal life has changed. These people are totally different now. They are frightened. You can't talk to them. I mean, it's as if someone, you know, the change is so deep, you know. The fear is so deep that it's very, very, very hard to come across, you know. And the other thing is that what for me has been a big change is that the people, the fact that we think politically differently, it means that we cannot be friends any longer. So I thought that I have much more friends than I have. All of a sudden you realize there are only a few people you can communicate to because politically we are different. There are differences, very sharp political differences now, you know.
What are the kind of political differences that have divided you from old friends?
National homogenization. Because I think, you know, the stage of national homogenization that I can accept is not, I mean, I can't go that far as they are, you know. The pressure to nationally homogenize, you know, to antagonize, it's so strong, and I cannot accept it, you know. I just cannot be reduced only to my nation. And when I oppose to that, when I write about that, when I criticize, and then I say that, you know, being reduced just to only one dimension, and this is the nation, for me is not enough. I don't feel good about that. Then I'm even by some of my friends seen as a traitor. So it's very painful for me.
As a traitor to your country?
Yeah.
So what do they want? Just Croats in Croatia? Or is it, what exactly do they want nationalistically, your friends who you've split with?
Well, it's not that. The thing is that... you know, if one third of the country, I can understand it perfectly. If one third of the country has been occupied, and if 10,000 people have been killed and 500,000 displaced, what they are saying is, well, you know, you can save your criticism for later. If you're a good Croat, and this is a question: who is good and who is not good Croat, or who is better Croat? You should condemn the aggression. You should say that Croatia has been attacked and so on and so on, which I am doing. It's not a problem. The problem is, however, that this government has been clever enough to manipulate in the way public opinion, in the way that it identifies the government with the people, you know, with Croatia, which I don't think it's the case. So if I criticize this government, it doesn't mean that I'm criticizing Croatia or that I'm not on the side of the people, you know. But this equation is very commonplace here. I mean, it's just a normal thing, you know. So if you criticize the government, they're saying, oh, no, I mean, why you are doing this? You are against Croatia. I'm not against Croatia. And, of course, Croatia, one-third of territory has been, you know, occupied, and we have been attacked by Serbian army. And so many people have been killed and this and that. But it doesn't mean that we all have to be, you know, so nationally homogenized.
My guest is journalist Slavinka Drakulic, who's joining us from her home in Zagreb, Croatia. How is your health? I know years ago you had a kidney transplant. Is the war affecting you getting what you need for your health?
Well, we have difficulties with getting the medications for not only for transplant patients, but for all patients, because the hospitals are full, and you know, the kind of aid that is coming, medical aid, is in terms of medication, is more for, you know, wounded and antibiotics and these kind of things. And so we have difficulties in getting, for example, cyclosporine, Just today I went to the hospital and they gave me only one bottle of cyclosporin, which is only for 10 days. And then in 10 days I have to come and see if there is more of cyclosporin, because they have to be very careful with that. It's a very expensive medication and they don't have it enough. So you are waiting every 10 days. Is it going to come more in donations or not? So this is one of the very... also one of the existential fears brought to me by the war, you know. But I'm not complaining about that. I hope, you know, there will be, and I hope the, you know, people will send in the medications for transplant patients.
What would happen if you didn't get it? I mean, what do you need it for? What does it do for you?
Oh, it is the cyclosporin and imuran and prednisone are keeping your kidneys staying in your organism. They are anti-rejection drugs.
I see.
You don't take them regularly, it means only that you are going to lose your organ, you know, so you have to be very careful. You have to take either combination of this medication or one medication, depends, it's individual for each patient, and I'm getting all three kind of medications. I was very, very afraid before in October and November last year that I'm not going to get these medications, you know, because the reserves were very, very low and it was not coming in, you know. So it's coming in very small doses, and I think everybody's getting it for now, but everybody is you know, very, very scared about it. It's one of the fears that you have to learn to live with.
Are you preparing for the possibility of fighting in Zagreb? Do you think that that's a possibility?
It couldn't be excluded. It couldn't be excluded. Not in one moment. The war could escalate, not only to Zagreb, but to all Croatia and even to Slovenia. The war is not over. It's not ended. It's very dangerous, and I think we just shouldn't delude ourselves or lie to ourselves saying it's over and Zagreb is out of danger or it's not going to spread more to the west. It could. It could, and it all depends, really, is someone going to say, that's enough. Let's stop it. Let's finish with that. It's just going too far.
Are you doing anything to prepare for that possibility of more fighting?
Well, you can't do anything about that. You can't. You know, the city is a big trap. There is nothing. I mean, all civilians are armed. I'm unarmed, of course, and you just couldn't do anything. You can't foresee it. You know, it's difficult. You are just only hoping, sitting there and hoping nothing is going to happen. But this is exactly what happened in Sarajevo. People were sitting there and hoping nothing will happen, and this is what is happening to them. I think that you know, Zagreb has a better chance of staying out of the fight. But you know, the war could progress, could go more to the south, which is Macedonia, of course, you know, and Kosovo and Albania. But it could also go more to the west. And I mean, I don't think that any possibility at this stage could be excluded.
One last question: what's the worst part of the day for you? The part where you worry the most?
Oh, well, it's the night. It's very difficult, you know, because I have terrible nightmares. And also it's very difficult, it's frightening to go to sleep because, you know, somehow while you're awake, you have this crazy idea, well, you know, if something happens, you can still find a way out or do something. But it's about 3 o'clock in the morning, that is probably between 3 and 4 or 3 and 5 in the morning, it's the worst part of the, actually it's not part of the day, it's part of the night, you know, when you are afraid the most, you're afraid to fall asleep because you don't know what will happen or what will the next day bring. But I'm not complaining. I don't want you to understand that I'm complaining, because there are much, much worse cases than, I mean, I don't consider myself to be even the case or anything, you know. I'm just articulating, I think, the fears of the other people too, which is...
Yes.
Somehow my task as a writer, you know.
Yes.
It's not, I'm surviving.
Right. Well, I wish you the best, and I thank you very much for sharing some of your thoughts with us.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Journalist Slavinka Dragulich spoke with us from her home in Zagreb. She's the author of How We Survived Communism and Even Laughed, and a new novel called Holograms of Fear. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Judy Nemac started out singing opera, but switched to jazz. Barbara Streisand without the hysterics is how she was recently described in the Village Voice. Coming up, we'll hear what she does with Come Rain or Come Shine, and we'll get a lesson in improvisation. Jonathan Spence has collected 30 years of his essays about China in his new book, Chinese Roundabout. Book critic John Leonard has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Moscow, an attorney for Russian President Boris Yeltsin lashed out today at the former Soviet Communist Party. His comments came during a trial challenging Yeltsin's banning of the party last fall. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
Yesterday, representatives of the Communist Party made their opening arguments. Today, Yeltsin's defenders had their turn. Sergei Sharkar, the leader of Yeltsin's team, launched a blistering attack on the party, calling it one of this century's most powerful organizations, a phantom government that stole the funds of the state and assassinated its opponents. He said Yeltsin had a constitutional obligation when he banned its activities and seized its property after last August's coup. Earlier, communist representatives softened their initial defiant stance of yesterday, defending the party for initiating perestroika and the democratization of the Soviet Union. Among those whom the court has called to testify is former Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev. But in an interview published today, Gorbachev is quoted as refusing to take part in the case under any circumstances. Gorbachev criticized both sides for their actions in court and said the case is splitting the country. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
Governor Bill Clinton spent the day in Arkansas, where the soon-to-be Democratic nominee showcased a program to help welfare mothers. But that did not distract the media's attention from the political question of the week. Who will Clinton pick for vice president? NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Clinton took his press entourage to Pine Bluffs today to show off one of his favorite projects, a training and education program that helps welfare mothers make the transition to work. But after the staged question and answer session, Clinton faced the cameras and was asked again about rumors that he would be meeting with Tennessee Senator Albert Gore tonight. Gore is considered to be at the top of Clinton's short list for vice president. As he has all along, Clinton refused to comment on that, but he did deny a press report that his wife Hillary had expressed dissatisfaction with another name on Clinton's short list, Nebraska Senator Bob Kerry. Hillary was reportedly angry about Kerry's primary campaign against Clinton, which turned vicious at times. Kerry met with Clinton last night at the governor's mansion. Yesterday in Washington, Clinton met with both Florida Senator Bob Graham and Pennsylvania Senator Harris Wofford. A decision about Clinton's running mate is expected very soon. In Little Rock, I'm Mara Liasson.
Another Rockefeller has announced as a candidate for political office. 47-year-old Lawrence Rockefeller has announced that he is running for the Republican Senate nomination against New York Senator Alphonse D'Amato. In making his announcement today, Rockefeller said it was abundantly clear to him that D'Amato is so much a part of the problem that he can never be part of the solution. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 2 points to close at 3,293. This is NPR News. Officials of Amoco have announced plans to cut 8,500 jobs over the next year and a half. These job cuts amount to about 15.5% of the company's workforce. The company says about 5,700 people have taken or will take early retirement or severance packages. Amoco is based in Chicago, and officials say the largest number of job cuts will be there. A new study suggests extra calcium in childhood could help prevent brittle bones at the end of life. This research in the New England Journal of Medicine also hints that government calcium recommendations for children may be too low. NPR's Michael Scholar reports.
Parents have been pushing kids to drink milk for generations. Now the evidence is in to back them up. Researchers at Indiana University studied identical twins, kids aged 6 to 14, who already got enough calcium from food to meet the government's recommended allowance. But one twin in each pair was given an extra daily dose, and after 3 years, those kids had bones up to 5% more dense than their twins. The bones were no bigger, and the kids grew no taller, but researchers say the denser bones should stay with the children throughout their lives and could help them avoid osteoporosis when they become old, though it's not yet clear if the benefit will stick. The study is continuing. Still, many researchers believe kids need more calcium than currently recommended. The new results will likely fuel efforts to add calcium to everyday foods, from orange juice to hamburgers. This is Michael Scholar in Washington.
A new survey finds that business failures increased nearly 16% in the first 5 months of this year compared to the same time last year. A Dun & Bradstreet study finds business failures climbed to more than 42,000 in the first 5 months of the year compared to about 36,000 last year. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. If you're interested in finding younger singers who are interpreting pop and jazz classics, let me introduce you to Judy Nemac. As music critic Francis Davis recently wrote in The Village Voice, Nemac combines the best of both worlds, a cabaret singer's respect for melody as written, and a jazz singer's eagerness to have a go at it. Well, Davis mentioned two worlds. She's also part of a third. Nemac was trained as an opera singer. Her new recording, Heart's Desire, is on Stash Records. It features pianist Kenny Barron. Before we meet her, let's hear Come Rain or Come Shine, the opening track of her new album.
Gonna love you like nobody's loved you. Come rain or come shine, high as a mountain, deep as a river. Come rain or shine. I guess when you met me, you thought I was just another one of those things. But don't you ever bet me, 'cause I'm gonna be true if you just let me.
Judy Nemac, you have a beautiful voice. You were actually trained as a coloratura. You studied opera.
Yeah, thank you for the compliment. I studied at New England, in New England Conservatory in Boston, after spending a few years in my hometown in Pasadena, California, studying privately.
How far did you get in opera?
Oh, I got to being in student productions in college, you know, that, and then I decided that I love singing and exploring that music, but I didn't want to dedicate my life to it because it was not free enough for me personally. And I was really fascinated with improvisation, and I wanted to use my classical technique but also find out about jazz and improv and really making the music my own.
How much did you know about jazz when you decided you were interested in it?
Oh, well, when I was studying classical, I was also singing jazz at night.
Oh,
and I was in the jazz, I was singing with a jazz big band at New England, and I got reprimanded by the head of the voice department at that time for singing jazz, and he assured me that I would lose my voice if I continued.
Why?
Because jazz was taboo for classical singers. The vocal production is very different, and classical teachers are... Or, I mean, this was in 1974, 75. At that time, they were even more adamant about singing only classical and that you would ruin your voice if you sang any pop music at all.
What's the difference between how you use your voice in opera and in pop that would account for hurting your voice?
A lot of times in pop music, singers will push the chest voice register up, and that... I also teach voice, and I find this a lot with people who don't study and who just try to get that belting sound in the pop music. They push the lower register up, and it causes a break in the voice and can damage the voice. But I already had had years of technical training, so I knew how to go through all the changes smoothly. I had a real good teacher, and so I've never had any problems that way.
I'm not sure I know enough technically to follow the
chest voice
chest
and hand voice.
Voice. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so chest voice is like your speaking voice, like ah, and head voice is ah. Chest voice is like ah, and head voice is ah. So if you take that chest voice, that belting voice, and push it up, it can cause problems. Is that clear?
Yeah, that helps a lot. And does it cause problems in part because it's putting a lot of stress on the throat?
It's not actually the throat, it's the vocal cords.
Right, right, right.
This is pretty technical. But anyway, the vocal cords, you use a different part of the vocal cords, and it can cause strain on them.
So how were you singing when you started singing jazz so that didn't happen?
Well, I started singing jazz with a real classical voice, which was... sounded kind of odd in retrospect. I made a record in 1978 when I was just switching over. And one of the main differences in classical singing is that you use a vibrato. You develop a vibrato that is your habitual sound, and you want to have that all the time. That's your regular tone. And anything else is a variation from, you know, a step away from that. In jazz, you start with a straight tone and you use a vibrato to add a color. So I started singing jazz, but I had this classical vibrato and it sounded kind of strange. It sounded more like, you know, musical comedy or theatrical kind of singing. And it took some time for me to get rid of that habit.
It's part of the reason why in opera there's a constant vibrato so that it projects.
Yeah, it develops a really rich series of overtones that fill out the tone. You want to, you know, have a really large sound so that you can sing over a full orchestra. That's part of the requirements for opera. In jazz, you have a microphone.
When you started singing jazz, did you ever feel like, well, that you should dirty up your voice somehow and get, quote, low down in order to sing it?
Oh, it's been a long process for me of dirtying up my sound and relaxing my inclination toward perfection. And that's one of the things that drew me toward classical music, too. I love the perfection of... you know, really having something perfectly in tune and perfectly in time and the beauty of that. And in jazz, that's great, but never at the expense of emotion and feeling.
Mm-hmm. I guess what I'm wondering is, I think some people who are classically trained when they start to sing jazz think that they have to do this almost caricatured version of getting low down, you know, and put this... I don't know, this like hoarseness into their voice, no matter how kind of clear their voice is. And
yeah.
I wonder if you went through a period like that of kind of like bending over the other way, you know, to kind of make up for the fact that you had this, you know, kind of beautiful and clear voice.
I never did. I just gradually have tried to come closer to what I think is my unique individual voice without trying to make it anything. I've accepted the fact that I'm white. You know, and I'm a trained musician, and I adore music, and, you know, I'm not just out there singing without knowing what I'm doing, you know, and I'm not ashamed of that.
What was it like before you accepted that you were white?
Well, I used to sort of end up singing with this kind of Billie Holiday accent, you know, that later on I would realize that's not my voice at all, you know. But a lot of people, when they sing jazz, they put on like a black kind of accent because it's part of the tradition.
Uh-huh.
And I just realized that, you know, it's in American music and it's been influenced by all kinds of people. Of course it came from black people and their struggles and... you know, but it also comes from the theater music that was composed by Cole Porter and Irving Berlin and Harold Arlen, and, you know, it's a combination.
My guest is singer Judy Niemack. More in a moment. This is Fresh Air. My guest is singer Judy Niemack. Before we return to the interview, let's hear something else from her new album, Heart's Desire. This is Over the Rainbow. She's accompanied by cellist Eric Friedlander.
Somewhere over the rainbow, way up high, there's a land that I heard of. Once in a lullaby, somewhere over the rainbow, skies are blue, and the dreams that you dare to dream, they really do come true. Someday I wish upon a star and wake up where the clouds are far behind me, where troubles melt like lemon drops away above the chimney tops. That's where you'll find me, somewhere.
That's Judy Niemack from her new album, Heart's Desire. Now, I know that you studied singing with the late jazz saxophonist Warren Marsh. What were some of the insights he gave you about singing and improvisation?
Well, Warren didn't know anything about singing, so luckily I had my teacher. But he really grounded me in the tradition of jazz. He started me out learning solos by Louis Armstrong, Lester Young, Roy Eldridge, then moving on into Charlie Parker, which was years worth of study. And he also made me a complete improvisational musician. He gave me a lot of study tools, learning the scales and the chords, composing solos, composing motifs that you change around, just like in classical music. You do it one way, a phrase one way, then you turn it upside down, then you turn it backwards, and you use these phrases through chord progressions. And he really gave me a firm grounding in all the harmonic and rhythmic structures of jazz, which was incredible.
Could I ask you to sing a harmonic exercise that he taught you?
Sure. One of the things he did in my first lesson, which I still use with my students, is he gave me a way to learn a song. Step one, learn the melody. So, for example, I've Got Rhythm. Just you have to be able to sing the melody with the metronome and nothing else. So that's your first lesson. Ba-ba-ba-da, ba-ba-ba-da. Etc. The second lesson is sing the roots of the chords in time. So the root is the bottom note of each chord. So for I Got Rhythm, it's ba da 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 da. Then you would sing 1, 3, 5, and 7 of each chord. But I'm going to have to do it slower. So, ba 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 do 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 do. That's in root position. Are you still with me?
Yeah, I am.
Then you improvise with those chord tones, which So instead of going da 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 da, you might go da 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 ba 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 ba. You fool around with those four notes on each chord, and then you by this time you really have a feeling in your body of what the harmony is.
Mm-hmm.
Then you go on to the scales and improvisation with the scales.
I saw a concert that you gave, this was years ago, sometime in the early or mid-80s, and I think it was exclusively scat singing. Did you go through a period of kind of abandoning the standards and going right to the improvisation?
Yes, and when I was studying with Warren, because he was very deeply into the improvisation, and that's what was attractive to me. And for years I was scatting. I was singing the melody, yeah, singing it nicely, but it was only just to get through it to get to the improvisation, you know. And this was in the early years. But over the last, gosh, about 6 or 7 years, I've really, really devoted myself to attaching emotionally to every lyric that I sing. And I threw out about half my repertoire because I realized that I had no feelings about the songs, although I liked them musically.
Hmm.
So, yeah, you're right. I did go through that of being, because it's really easy for me to be in the music and in the improvisation, and that's my natural bent. But now I'm enjoying so much, you know, experiencing the songs emotionally, being able to bring some feeling to the audience.
Judy Niemack. She'll perform at Fat Tuesdays in New York, July 28th through 30th. Here's more from her new album, Heart's Desire, on Stash Records. Judy Niemack. By the way, if you like singers, tune in again tomorrow when our guest will be Eileen Farrell. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing from NPR's John Itzty in Munich about the conclusion of the summit of seven leading industrialized nations, which should come up with some help for Boris Yeltsin, but not with a solution to the stalemate in the world trade talks, nor to any new plans for stimulating the world economy. We'll also be hearing a special report today from Tom Jelton, a profile of a family in Sarajevo, the capital of Bosnia-Herzegovina that's been torn by civil war over these past several months. And also a talk with Milan Panic, the Serbian immigrant to America who has gone back to Belgrade to be prime minister of the new Yugoslavia.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. A year ago, book critic John Leonard took his first trip to China to see for himself what he'd only read about in books, books by scholar Jonathan Spence about Chinese history and culture. Now Spence has a new book, a collection of essays and book reviews written over the last 30 years. John Leonard has this review of Chinese Roundabout.
Exactly a year ago, our first afternoon in Beijing, on a vacation to the culture that invented both the kite and the wheelbarrow, fresh from the Temple of Heaven, where Ming architecture had been showing off with its compass points and echo wells, its royal dragons and elephant chariots, where mandarins in the 15th century wore the winter solstice like a wristwatch. We looked in Tiananmen Square at the ghosts and the balloons. But there were books, too, in our heads. And most of these books were by Jonathan D. Spence, the China scholar at Yale. From Spence, in his memory palace of Matteo Ricci, we knew all about Mings. From Spence, in the search for modern China, we were full of historical principles and trivia. From Wang Lun's White Lotus Rebellion against the Manchu dynasty back in the 1770s, to the fact that Vinegar Joe Stilwell, in his secret World War II dispatches, referred to Chiang Kai-shek by the codename Peanut. From Spence, in The Gate of Heavenly Peace, we also knew that students had been shot down before in Tiananmen Square, poets beheaded, workers crushed. Last July in China, we saw through his eyes as well as our own. Chinese Roundabout is a collection of Spence's essays and book reviews for more than three decades of obsessive thinking. They represent the scholar distracted, improvising, occasional, polemical, celebratory, footnoting. A book of laughter, but not forgetting. It's a kind of jazz in counterpoint to his great choral works. There isn't a page without a wonderful anecdote, nor a paragraph that doesn't gleam with intelligence. We go to Tiananmen, of course, in 1989, but also to the court of Emperor Wu. We meet eccentrics like Mendes Pinto, whose late 16th century travels is less an account of a China he probably never even saw than a savage satire on Portuguese empire building. And Sidney Gamble, whose terrific 20th century photos were snapped from a bamboo shoulder chair with a sunproof canopy, borne by four coolies over roads that even soldiers were inclined to avoid. We sit in something like awe as Spence takes issue, on the one hand, with my old Berkeley professor, the Taoist Joseph Levinson, on the vitality of Confucianism in the modern era, and on the other hand, with the redoubtable Joseph Needham, about whose many volumes on science and civilization in ancient China Spence has some doubts. There are tributes to such worthies as the translator Arthur Whaley, and to Spence's own mentor, John K. Fairbank, and essays on Chinese food, film, poetry, medicine, physics, and opium. In a dazzling display of comparative cultures and literatures, we look at China through the novels not only of André Malraux, but of Pearl Buck, John Hersey, and James Clavell, of Kafka in The Great Wall of China, Hermann Hesse in The Glass Bead Game, Elias Canetti in Auto da Fe, and Bertolt Brecht in The Good Woman of Sichuan. To the court of the Mings in 1601, the Jesuit priest Matteo Ricci, who had translated Confucian classics into Latin and Euclid into Chinese, presented a prism, a clock, and a harpsichord. Likewise, in this rich and generous collection, Spence has also come bearing gifts. The Mings themselves, and the Ricci's, the Malraux's, the Manchu's, the wheelbarrow, and so many kites the mind takes gaudy flight.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Chinese Roundabout by Jonathan Spence, published by Norton. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk and Audrey Voblaitis. Our program is directed this week by Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet a singer who is loved for her interpretations of opera and American popular song. At the age of 72, Eileen Farrell no longer does concerts, but she's still recording songs. We'll go back to the days when her parents had a vaudeville act. We'll hear about the radio show she used to host on CBS, her five seasons with the Met, and more. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us.